Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, who discusses the triggers that set off the current East-West crisis in Ukraine and options to reach a negotiated settlement. Maya Nair, the group People Concerned About Chemical Safety, who talks about West Virginia's lax regulations of the chemical industry that contributed to the recent massive toxic chemical spill of drinking water in the state. And author and environmental activist Harvey Wasserman, who examines the continuing threat of radiation leaks at Japan's failed Fukushima nuclear power complex on the third anniversary of the disaster. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In another chapter of a 20-year court battle over oil pollution in Ecuador's rainforest, Chevron won a significant battle in discrediting a $9 billion judgment against the oil giant. In 2011, Chevron brought a RICO suit against New York lawyer Stephen Donziger, who represented Ecuadorian villagers in the case. The oil company claims Donziger used fraud to win the massive class action lawsuit in Ecuador's courts. The Ecuadorian plaintiffs are currently seeking payment from Chevron in Canadian, Argentinian, and Brazilian courts. In a lengthy ruling, U.S. District Judge Lewis Kaplan concluded Donziger and his legal team had engaged in repeated acts of fraud, bribery, and money laundering. Kaplan also banned the plaintiffs from using U.S. courts to seek payment from Chevron. The case revolved around the testimony of pro-Chevron witness, former Ecuadorian judge Alberto Guerra, who claims he was paid to rule against Chevron in the case. The oil company has paid over $10 million to press the RICO case against Donziger. The group Amazon Watch, which has mobilized support for the Ecuadorian pollution victims throughout years of litigation, said the U.S. judge's ruling is an example of Chevron buying and bullying its way to a verdict, with 60 law firms and thousands of legal professionals hell-bent on exhausting the Ecuadorians and their allies. Chevron's aggressive tactics are being closely watched by other major multinational corporations vulnerable to similar multi-billion-dollar lawsuits. Fracking and the natural gas boom have come to the quiet shores of Chesapeake Bay. Plans for the construction of a new liquefied natural gas terminal in Maryland have alarmed environmentalists, who are calling the project the next Keystone XL pipeline, designed to export LNG to Japan and India. The proposed LNG plant, backed by Dominion Resources, could create hundreds of jobs and has the active support of construction and energy unions. They are pitted against local climate activists who worry the LNG terminal will lead to the expansion of natural gas fracking across Maryland, endanger local water supplies, and pose a health hazard to residents and workers employed in the fast-growing fracking industry. Future exports of U.S. natural gas will get a bigger push as the Obama White House seeks to counter Russian gas exports to Ukraine and Europe after fallout from the current standoff in Crimea. Even as proposed LNG export facilities wait for federal permits, energy companies are signing new agreements to ship 12 million tons of LNG overseas. The climate action group 350.org is leading opposition to the LNG plants in Maryland and the Pacific Northwest. 350.org's Phil Arignanu told the news magazine In These Times, "There's not much in the way of regulation of natural gas right now. The industry knows it's coming, so they are getting all the infrastructure built and grandfathered in." 2 years ago, Sonja van Wyk moved her father into a nursing home in the Netherlands, offering to prepare coffee, cook some meals, and talk with residents. Today, such tasks are required for families of senior citizens moving into nursing homes. While the required commitments only take a few hours a month, the new policies have raised concern in the Netherlands, home of one of the world's most comprehensive welfare states. The scaled-back government commitment to social programs is what Dutch King Willem Alexander describes as a new participation society, where community members must do more to help others before aid can be expected from the state. These new policies have been implemented under the doctrine of economic austerity, which has been moving across the European continent since the 2008 economic meltdown. The Christian Science Monitor reports that the Netherlands' conservative government has increased the nation's retirement age and scaled back unemployment benefits, as well as health care subsidies. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Tensions remain high in Ukraine after the Crimean parliament voted to approve a declaration of independence that will take effect if Crimea's residents approve a vote to secede from Ukraine and join the Russian Federation in a referendum scheduled for March 16th. With thousands of Russian troops without insignia continuing to occupy Crimea, leaders of Ukraine's interim government have called for the formation of a new National Guard and requested military aid from the U.S. and Britain under the post-Cold War Budapest Memorandum. Both Russian President Vladimir Putin and ousted Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych consider the interim government that was installed in Kiev after the three-month protest occupation there to be illegitimate. They assert that top posts in the new government, including Deputy Prime Minister, Deputy Secretary of National Security, and Secretary of the Ukrainian National Security and Defense Council, are now in the hands of far-right fascist and anti-Semitic groups, Svoboda and Right Sector. Putin says Russia has responded to the threat that these extremist groups pose to the Russian-speaking population in Crimea and eastern Ukraine. Washington and the European Union's threat of economic sanctions against Russia, as well as NATO reconnaissance flights over Poland, Romania, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, have increased already heightened tensions over the situation in Ukraine. Your reporter spoke with Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, who discusses the triggers that set off the current east-west crisis in Ukraine and options to reach a negotiated settlement.
Since the Clinton administration, the Bill Clinton administration in the 1990s, the U.S.-led West has been on a steady march toward post-Soviet Russia, beginning with what Russian scholar George Kennan called the most fateful era of the post-Cold War period, the expansion of NATO all the way to the Russian border. NATO now includes three formerly Soviet countries, eight or nine Warsaw Pact countries. This may not resonate with your listeners, but it is a touchstone in Russia for a failed post-Soviet, post-Cold War world, and also for broken promises. Former Secretary of State James Baker in the George H.W. administration promised then Russian leader Mikhail Gorbachev that when the Berlin Wall collapsed and Germany was reunified, NATO would not expand. NATO, being a Cold War alliance, a military alliance, would not expand one inch eastward. It has expanded. And I think that needs to be a backdrop as we witness events in Ukraine. I also think we need to go back to last November when the European Union proposed to Ukraine that it join the European Association Agreement. First of all, it offered $160 million a year for 5 years. And furthermore, there were security arrangements in this European Association Agreement, which the U.S. Western media has barely reported. These agreements would have led Ukraine to move fairly quickly into NATO. But what's more important as we sit here today is it didn't need to be an either-or situation. The Russian government offered a tripartite agreement. As former German Prime Minister Gerhard Schroeder writes today in the German media, it did not need to be either or. It was a failure of the EU and the West to make it such. This both and alternative would have been more reasonable because Ukraine needs partnership with both sides. Ukraine is a bankrupt country. It has been looted by its oligarchs, its political elite over these years. And let me finish here because as the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, sits in Kiev tonight, our reporter out of Kiev says that as details emerge about the IMF loan, there is a sequester plan by the Ukrainian Finance Ministry, which includes a variety of deep reductions in social expenditures, such as cutting pensions by 50%. This will be perhaps more of a trigger for conflict in the next months, if this goes through, than what is happening with Crimea.
Recognizing that Russia has legitimate security interests in the future of Ukraine, and also recognizing the fact that the United States and the European Union offered Ukraine a yes or no answer on whether they would be affiliated economically with Russia or the EU, Who is responsible for this serious strategic error which brought us to the current crisis? Obviously, there could have been a compromise to have Ukraine be part of both worlds, both the Russian and European worlds economically. But that didn't happen. Why? That's a key question here, isn't it?
Key question. And we sit here today and we look back at history 25, 30 years ago. We look back at just these recent months. This tragedy, because it is ripping Ukraine apart, and it is leading perhaps to a very dangerous escalation with NATO planes in Poland and Romania, with Russian troops in Crimea. How we come down from this may be one answer to your question, because the de-escalation will require security guarantees for Russia, will require, in many ways, maintaining the territorial integrity of Ukraine. It will need new and free elections, if that's possible, which will be inclusive, because Ukraine is so divided that if you don't have the inclusion of eastern and southern parts of Ukraine, which are primarily Russian-speaking, how will the government in Ukraine be representative? There needs to be a pledge, a security guarantee to Russia, reaffirming the pledge that NATO will not extend into Ukraine. And finally, if Ukraine is going to be economically prosperous or even economically sustainable, Ukraine needs to be part of both the EU and the Russian customs union. So there needs to be a dialing back, if it's at all possible, to what would have been more common sense. As I, you know, said, less bluster, more common sense is needed. Why force Ukraine, as the EU did in November, to decide between Russia and the EU?
Well, Katrina, just a final question here. There are those in Washington and Moscow, as you mentioned earlier, who are part of the war party, people who want to see tensions escalate. Some of these people, neocons like John McCain and former Vice President Dick Cheney, who seem hell-bent on reviving the Cold War. And I'm wondering, from where you sit, who benefits from a revival of the Cold War and severe tensions and strains with Russia at this moment?
Well, the American people certainly don't benefit, nor does this country, which needs to rebuild itself at home. The military-industrial complex, as you've probably followed, there's been a drumbeat against the small, barely any defense cuts that have been made due to sequestration in these last months. The oil and gas companies benefit because there'll be a march on to expand the U.S.'s natural gas program and fracking. The neocons and the outdated retro dinosaur-like think tanks will benefit as they howl at the moon to continue a Cold War that benefits no one. And the issues that should preoccupy us, extreme poverty in the world, inequality, climate change, weapons of mass destruction, none of those critical issues which we should tend to in non-military ways will benefit. So I think we should do all we can to ensure that this doesn't move into a robust, full-throated Cold War and find a way forward without it. No one will benefit.
That was Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine and author of the book The Change I Believe In, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama. For more perspectives on the crisis in Ukraine, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. 2 months after the leak of 10,000 gallons of a chemical used in coal processing, known as MCHM, into the public water supply that 300,000 West Virginians depend on, almost no one in the affected area is drinking the water. That despite reassurances from the West Virginia American Water Company 4 days after the January 9th spill that the system had been flushed and the water was safe to use. The leak came from a holding tank owned by Freedom Industries, whose tank farm was located on the edge of the Elk River that flows into the larger Kanawha River that moves through Charleston, West Virginia's capital and largest city. Saturday, March 8th was the last day of the state legislative session, and supporters of a bill to improve safety of the water supply gathered in the Capitol Rotunda for a rally. One of the speakers there was Maya Nye, a spokesperson for people concerned about chemical safety, who is also active with the group West Virginia Free. She focused her comments on concerns with water contamination specific to women. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Nye after the rally. Here she explains some of the history of the lax laws and regulations of West Virginia's chemical industry, one of the state's biggest, and the special concerns of women related to toxic pollution.
So West Virginia Free is doing holding listening sessions for women in water to hear women's concerns around how they've been dealing in the water crisis. I mean, particularly, I think you're probably aware that after the water ban was lifted, pregnant women were then told that they should not be drinking the water, and the water has still not been determined safe. Actually, for anyone, the water has not been determined safe yet by our Bureau for Public Health. So pregnant women technically still necessarily shouldn't be drinking the water until it's determined safe. So we are holding listening sessions to hear how women have been dealing through the crisis, and we're talking about in all of our public forums.
I read something that the CDC did actually use the word safe recently, that it was safe to drink the water.
The CDC did say that, but the Bureau for Public Health, who has primacy over safe drinking water, the Bureau for Public Health is the one that actually has to use the word safe in order for it to be determined as safe, and it has not yet been stated as such.
So what are you finding? What are these women's concerns?
Well, I mean, people don't want to bathe their children in it. Women who are pregnant don't want to come in contact with the water. I mean, the amount of time that it actually takes to attempt to, you know, boil water on a pot to take a shower, you know, to bathe yourself in, it's a very time-consuming process. It completely interrupts daily lives. And I know most people aren't drinking the water. Some people have gone back to bathing in it and laundering with it, but nobody is drinking the water.
Mental health must just be devastated. Has that come up at all? I mean, aside, you know, from any physical things that might go wrong.
This is a trauma that's happened to our community, and it really has been a traumatic event. It's changed people's perception of what they consider safe on a basic human level. So, yeah, it's definitely impacted people's mental health. And their ability to cope in this situation has been, you know, it's been a very difficult situation. So, yes.
I talked to one woman. She's a single woman with a very successful career and, I guess, enough money. She's actually renting an apartment in a safe zone, she said. And she just burst out crying twice talking to me. And she doesn't have any kids to worry about. And, you know, and she's not poor, so she can afford to buy the water. And I only can relate to it because we were passing out water the first day I was here. And I had one bottle of clean water in the car. And we were gone for several, you know, like 6 hours. And I thought, oh, my God, I can't ask any of these people if I can fill up my water from their tap.
Yeah. They still have bottled water at the Capitol for all the legislators. So I think that kind of goes to tell you something. They've actually, one of the big issues is that they've just reintroduced tap water in the school systems, which many parents are very unhappy with. Because, you know, most people are protecting their children in their own way, in their own homes. But once they're released into the school system, they don't have the ability to do that. So that's been a real uproar here in the last week.
One of the women I talked to was older. I don't know if she had her own grandchildren in the system or what, but she was outraged by that.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, I would give my kids bottled water and tell them don't touch anything else. And I imagine a lot of parents have probably just given their kids bottled water.
Right, and packing their lunches, because otherwise the school lunches are being made with tap water at this point. So, yeah. This chemical is one of 62,000 chemicals that was grandfathered in under the Toxic Substance Control Act as not having to have proper toxicological testing so that we know actually how it impacts our health. So as a woman of childbearing age, I'm extremely concerned about that because I don't know what coming in contact with this chemical will do to my potentially unborn children. And no studies at this moment in time have been done to actually determine that in any way, shape, or form. So it's really, it's scary. And so we're really hoping that these toxicological tests will be done. Everyone just wants to know, how is exposure to this chemical impacting our health? So the tests really need to be done. At this point, the CDC, the governor has asked the CDC to perform those tests. I'm not even sure if we know who to trust anymore, if we trust the CDC to provide us with the proper information, because they had given us information that was poorly informed to tell us at what level we should be drinking the water. So I would say an ill-informed decision that they made based on tests done on lab rats by the company Eastman Manufacturing, who produces the chemical. So, you know, I don't necessarily think that that's the proper test.
Well, one thing I don't understand is, why is it taking so long to get these tests done that would show whether or not it's safe? And like this woman here, and a scientist was saying, you know, maybe we'll find out that it actually is safe, that it's really not that toxic.
Mm-hmm. I think funding, and also I think the fact that, again, because it's one of the chemicals that was grandfathered in under the Toxic Substance Control Act, I'm not sure there's a whole lot of political will to have it tested at this point in time.
That was Maya Nye with the West Virginia group, People Concerned About Chemical Safety. Find more information on West Virginia's toxic chemical spill and the movement to strengthen regulations there and across the nation on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. March 11th marked the third anniversary of the devastating earthquake and tsunami that struck Japan's coastline, killing more than 15,000 people and leaving 300,000 homeless. The earthquake also triggered the triple meltdown and four explosions at the Fukushima nuclear power complex located near the epicenter of the tremor. Since the tsunami destroyed the nuclear reactor's backup cooling systems, there have been continuing leaks of radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. Contaminated water is being stored in 1,200 tanks located on the Fukushima site, but they are prone to leaks. While the Tokyo Electric Company and Japanese government are expecting a 30 to 40 year time frame to decommission the failed reactors, they say their urgent mission is to dispose of the contaminated water, the most likely option being a release of the stored radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. Since the 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster, scientists say as many as 20 trillion becquerels of cesium-137, 10 trillion becquerels of strontium-90, and 40 trillion becquerels of tritium were released into the Pacific Ocean. Scientists further predict that radiation from the Fukushima reactors will reach the waters off the U.S. West Coast sometime this April. On the eve of the third anniversary of the earthquake and nuclear disaster, thousands of Japanese citizens protested Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's plan to reopen some of the nation's 48 nuclear plants that were closed down in 2011. Your reporter spoke with author and environmental activist Harvey Wasserman, who examines the continuing danger of the radiation leaks at Fukushima and the threat to human health and the ecosystem posed by the global nuclear power industry.
As soon as there's a nuclear reaction at Chernobyl or Three Mile Island, the bomb tests in the South Pacific and Nevada, even at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, now at Fukushima, the response is instant and immediate and automatic. And it's always the same thing. Not enough radiation came out to harm anybody. Now you have all the apologists. They have no idea how much radiation escaped from Fukushima, what kind it is, where it's gone, who will be impacted. What we do know for sure, and there's one thing we know for sure, and that is that there is no safe dose of radiation. There is no number that you can assign to a dose of radiation that you can prove to be perfectly harmless. This is especially important when it comes to pregnant women, because it was shown in 1956 by Dr. Al Stewart that X-raying pregnant women led to a doubled childhood leukemia rate among their offspring. She was attacked, as you might expect, and fought for 30 years, and finally the medical profession had to concede and come around that, well, we do not X-ray pregnant women. You also wear a bib when you go in the dentist's office and the X-ray technician leaves the room. And unfortunately, we can't leave the room in this case. It's the planet Earth. And so Fukushima has spewed out a gargantuan and continues to spew out gargantuan quantities of radiation. We do know that it will be arriving in the water on the West Coast sometime this summer. This is detectable cesium that could only be coming from Fukushima, and it is not harmless. So, you know, those of us who like to go to the beach are going to face a decision. Why should we have to face this kind of decision in the year 2014 when commercial nuclear power is an economic catastrophe? The only people who make money on nuclear power are large corporations. They're completely corporate controlled and have no really, really effective control on the part of the public. And, you know, we're seeing that at Fukushima, where TEPCO is turning the cleanup into a huge profit center.
Harvey, I know you've been tracking public opinion in Japan as regards the plan by the Japanese Prime Minister to restart these
nuclear power plants, the 48 nuclear power plants that were shut down after the tsunami and after the Fukushima disaster. There have been very large demonstrations against nuclear power across Japan in these intervening few years. What can you tell us about public opinion in Japan right now? Are people supportive of the government plan to restart these nuclear plants?
No, absolutely not. There's a very strong, the polls all show a very strong majority in opposition to reopening nuclear plants in Japan. You know, you have essentially a fascist government there now that has come in with American support, which is pushing to reopen these reactors and pushing to prevent the public from knowing what's going on, spending huge amounts of money on public relations, you know, manufacturing consent, as Noam Chomsky would say, and denying the science that shows that there are dangers to the public. And then, in fact, there has been a spike in thyroid abnormalities. You know, this is a very, very ugly situation.
What is the situation with seafood that is fished out of the Pacific Ocean? Tuna, for instance, migrate around some of the currents that bring the waters near Fukushima up towards the Aleutian Islands and down the West Coast. Is there anybody or any agency measuring the potential radiation in seafood that's sold in U.S. markets?
Not that I know of. There was some testing done on tuna in Southern California, and every tuna they tested showed radiation from Fukushima. And it is traceable. There's certain isotopes of cesium, tellurium, and some other elements that are clearly related to the disaster. So seafood has become problematic, but there's no one giving you hard numbers. And I don't think that's an accident. The radiation is pouring into the Pacific. And it, we don't know, you know, there's no studies on the long-term health impacts on starfish, on sea lions, on sardines, on salmon, you know, on other species. Nobody has that those numbers. And so when these people tell you that, you know, the amounts are too tiny to harm anything, there's no data to show that. And so these denials are completely commercial-based. The one good piece of news is that solar energy is proceeding, green power, renewables, efficiency, conservation. These technologies have exploded in a good way, so that renewables are much, much cheaper than nuclear, much cheaper than much of the fossil fuel industry now. They are terrified of renewables. But this revolution is happening, and we can't make it come fast enough. The most important thing we can do to save this planet is to shut the nuclear reactors as soon as possible, but before the next Fukushima, for God's sakes.
That was Harvey Wasserman, editor at nukefree.org and author of Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth. Find links to Wasserman's articles and more information on the Fukushima disaster on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.